Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The University Press occupies a special place in the publishing world at a time when a lot of the big publishing houses are working to try to sell as many books as they possibly can. University presses try to stress quality over quantity. They put out books that many people feel otherwise might not exist. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about the role of the University Press, and our guest is Willis Regeer. He is director of the University of Illinois Press, which is one of the larger university presses in the country. We'll talk also about some of the challenges facing publishers today, both big and small. Maybe get some of his thoughts on the future of the book, which in some people's minds may still remain a bit in question. And, of course, take questions from people who are listening. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about our guest. He's been director of the U of I Press since November of 1998. He has a PhD in English and American Literature from University of Nebraska, where he taught in the Department of English there. He began his career in publishing as the reviews editor for the literary journal Prairie Schooner and joined the University of Nebraska Press as its humanities editor in 1979. He then went on to be editor-in-chief and director of that press. Then he went to Baltimore. He was the director of the Johns Hopkins University Press. He's twice been elected to the board of directors of the Association of American University Presses and served as its president in 2000 and 2001. And we're pleased to have him here. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much
for being here.
And happy Lincoln's birthday.
Let me turn your microphone on there. Good. Yeah, well, yes. And it's certainly significant on a variety of levels. But one of the things I know from having looked through the catalog, and this says something I think about university presses. First of all, that university presses, this one and others, feel this very strong commitment to publish things that's about their state and their region. So not surprising, the U of I Press over the years has published a number of titles about Abraham Lincoln. So well, ties us into where we are today.
It's one of the great things about being the director at the University of Illinois Press. We are deeply involved in Lincoln studies. Illinois is full of heroes, but we have a hero, Lincoln, and a heroine, Jane Addams, that we are particularly interested in.
Yeah. These days are not real good ones for, well, maybe not for anybody. Certainly the economic downturn affects all kinds of businesses, and it has affected publishing. And in recent months, we have certainly read stories about the fact that at many of the large publishing houses, they're laying people off. Just recently, I think it was HarperCollins got rid of two of its top people, and that was one of the houses that to that point, I think they had really not announced big layoffs, but finally they said, yes, we're doing that as well. And I'm sure that they're all very concerned about how they're going to be affected by the economy and their business. Are people within the publishing world particularly concerned?
Yes, they are. There are three forces that are now operating to reduce book sales in this country. Mm-hmm. One is the reduction of library budgets. Our colleagues at the libraries are having to suffer from very painful decisions. And some of those will affect us. The general recession has affected the general market for bookstores. Even Amazon is now pushing to sell electronic books instead of books. Mm-hmm. And the third factor is electronic books, how people are spending more time with screen media than with print media.
Yeah. Well, that's something that certainly at some point I want to talk about because I think that it's an interesting development, and I'm sure that people who are in the business of writing and publishing and selling books are looking at this and wondering what exactly it's going to mean. Maybe we'll save that for a little bit. One of the things that I had the opportunity to do was just take a look at some information coming from the Association of American University Presses, and I was really struck by the fact that there are a lot of university presses and there is a tremendous range from the big ones to the small ones, what sort of budgets they have to work with, how many titles a year they come out. Can you give us some sense about just the spread here among the big, from the biggest to the smallest?
Sure. There are several ways to categorize university presses. Size is one, and that size is represented in two different ways, the actual annual revenue brought in by the press or the number of new titles issued by that press. By far the largest university press in the world is Oxford University Press, which has a budget of over $660 million by the last published figure, which is 100 times the size of most state university presses. Mm-hmm. Some presses are very small, only doing a dozen books a year. A few do hundreds. We are one of those that does about 140 to 150 a year.
So that's a seems to me really to be a significant number. If you set aside Oxford and Harvard and Yale and places like that, that if you can do more than 100 titles a year, to me that seems pretty. That seems a pretty significant number.
And to us too, our staff works very hard to produce this number of books. One of the other interesting figures when you compare university presses to publishers as a whole is that university presses are much more productive than most commercial publishers, certainly the large ones, in terms of issuing the numbers of books per person.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said that it was the Oxford University Press was the biggest one, and it had a budget in the hundreds of millions. So what's the budget for the U of I Press?
We do about $5 million of sales in books every year, plus another $1 million in journals.
And how does that compare with your costs? Do sales, essentially sales licensing and so forth, basically cover the cost of running the press, or does the university also kick in some money?
We are grateful that our university supports us. They support something like a sixth of our operating income. That makes a lot of things possible that we couldn't otherwise do, and the university then appreciates the fact that we turn that into a business which generates an awful lot more.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the university appreciates the fact that it's part of the effort to get the name of the University of Illinois out there and have people know about the university.
I think so, and I hope so.
Yeah. Do you feel a particular commitment, or maybe the question should be, so do you have an idea that, say, some percentage of your titles, you want those to be things that are actually written by people who are on the faculty of the university?
Oh, definitely. Our most important constituency is our faculty. We publish about 15% of our books by university faculty, and that's not just at the Urbana-Champaign campus. We also are the university press for the University of Illinois Chicago and Springfield.
Mm-hmm. And that is that fairly typical of university presses, that in the sense that most of the books that they publish are not written by faculty of that university?
I would say for presses our size and larger, yes, that's true.
Mm. Do you, I wonder if, and I ask this question knowing that I think in recent years there have been some universities where they have talked about closing their presses.
Yes.
I'm not certain, and you can tell me if there are some that actually have gone to the point of doing that. But is it now the case that people like you, who are responsible for running university presses, are having to put more effort into justifying your existence to the people that run the universities?
I feel that my colleagues have had to do that forever.
Hmm.
The history of Oxford University Press is full of moments where Oxford University Press was in jeopardy. We feel very happy that our university seems to appreciate us. We have excellent relations with our administration and with our faculty and with our faculty committee, which is our major liaison to the faculty. We don't feel particularly jeopardized as a unit, but we certainly feel that our enterprise is under much more pressure now than it has been recently.
Yeah. Have there been places where there have been university presses that have been in business for a long time where the administration or the Board of Governors or whoever finally made the decision, they said, you know, given where we are, there's just no way that we can continue to operate?
Yes, there are some famous cases. Cornell University Press itself, one of the major Ivy League university presses, has closed twice. But the university has felt the necessity for a university press severely enough that they have reopened them, and the Cornell is back, still going strong. In the 1990s, Iowa State University Press was sold as a press to a British publisher, Blackwell's, which sold not only its inventory and its contracts, but its name, so that Blackwell's could publish for some years under the name Iowa State University Press.
Hmm. I was looking at, again, at some figures from the AAUP, the Association of Presses, and these are a couple of years old. But going back a couple of years, the total number of books, if you looked at the total number of books published by all the university presses, it was about 10,000,
right,
something like that.
Right.
And that the total number of books published in the U.S. by all publishers was 172,000. So contrary to what we hear about people not reading, there seem to be a lot of books published, and those that the university press publish are a pretty small percentage of the total, 10,000 as compared to 172,000. So this, I suppose this goes back to the this question of why we need university presses, and administrators who might say, well, most of our faculty seem to find somebody that will publish their work, and there are a lot of books out there. So why should we, University of fill in the blank, be spending a few million dollars a year so that we could operate this small press? I mean, does the world really need the books that we are publishing? And would there be any lack of books if we closed our press?
Well, there goes the rest of the hour, David. let me give you some more statistics to put this into a larger frame.
Okay.
There are something like 102 university presses that are members of the AAUP that would fit into that number, adding up to 10,000 books a year. As you said, 170,000 more or less books published every year, 10,000 by university presses. There are 73,000 publishers in this United States, some of them very, very small, that are publishing books about how to collect antiques. Lots of books that are published by literary presses. So when you do the actual mathematics of it, it comes down to something like this. University presses are 0.0015% of the presses in the United States that are publishing something like 8% of the books published in the country. That, I think, will give you a real good suggestion of how busy university presses are. Mm-hmm. But it should also suggest how important the work that they do is to the world at large. I could spend the rest of the hour going through all of the important books that have been published by university presses. I could probably spend most of that time concentrating on only the books published by Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
But many of these books are exceedingly important, but not necessarily to a mass market. For instance, we published the great text by Benjamin Perry on Aesop, which is the collection of the Aesop fables in Greek and Latin. This was done in the 1940s, a phenomenal publishing project that we've still kept in print. No commercial press would have touched that. But every scholar who has any real interest in Aesop, and there are a number of them, rely upon this book as their basic text.
So this gets at the obvious question, and one that I'm sure that you have a ready answer for, and that is, if university presses didn't exist, if they weren't publishing the titles that you do, would anyone publish those books?
Some of them would, yes. That for certain kinds of books, university presses compete with the large commercial mm-hmm. publishers,
mm-hmm.
and we try to do that because we need to generate more money than the University of Illinois can give us in order to publish all the books we do. But there are vast numbers of very important books that commercial presses have no interest in, or their editors have no sense of.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Willis Regeer. He is the director of the University of Illinois Press, and as someone who has been involved in Illinois, in this press, in the University of Illinois Press, for quite a while. He has had this job since 1998, and before that also worked at the University of Nebraska Press and the Johns Hopkins University Press. And we've been talking about the role of the university press. I think we also try and get into some issues maybe that have to do with, touch on the challenges that all publishers are facing today, and they certainly are considerable. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800 9455. Those are the numbers. So the U of I Press, how long has it been in business now?
We just celebrated our 90th anniversary last year.
So now we're at 91, so
right.
Somewhere here in 91 years. For let us say for the for a university press like this one, we'll just let's take the University of Illinois Press. What is a good sales number? If you have a title, how many books would you have to sell for you to say, now that is a good number?
That's a great question, which goes back to the comparison with commercial presses. A commercial press will want to sell something like 10,000 copies of a book to make it succeed. Depending upon our pricing structure, we can sell several hundred and still make it work. But the books that make us happiest are those that do sell in the thousands.
Mm. And is that generally for, I suppose, again, if you're looking at the Oxford University Press, maybe they're going to expect to sell more titles. But again, they're also not publishing mass market books either. So
David.
Is Oxford publishing things that would be considered to be mass market books?
Well, they would be considered trade books.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, what if, and certainly, well, on this program, we've had people from those who were published by those and publishing in major significant books that are well-reviewed. You see them widely for sale, history, biography, political science,
right.
That's sort of their special niche. Well, so for the Oxford University Press, I mean, what would be a good number?
I would think that their numbers would not differ from ours all that much. The great difference between Oxford University Press and Illinois is that they publish so much more, that they publish over 2,000 books a year. And between them, Oxford and Cambridge account for about half of all university press books published every year.
So as you're going, if you're looking at a book, you're trying to decide, will we publish this book or not? Do you try to make a determination about how many copies of that book you think that you'd be likely to sell? Is that something that one can really even know in advance?
That's a vital decision we take with every book we consider. And we do it before we contract it, and we do it before we send to the printers because conditions change that rapidly. We try to make every book pay its own way, one way or another, which is why some of our books bear prices that might spook the average buyer.
All right. Well, we have a couple of callers here. We'd like to bring them into the conversation. We have one to start out with in Champaign, and they're line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I will keep it short and sweet. What would you suggest for someone who's close to finishing their bachelor's degree who would like to break into the publishing field, both in general and into university publishing in specific?
It depends upon the career path you really want to take. Depending upon whether you want to become an acquisitions editor or marketer or work in electronic publishing, there are all sorts of paths available. Usually the job that most people want is acquisitions because it's such a thrilling job. You get to meet so many brilliant people day after day. And for that, the best route is to get involved with publishing through a scholarly journal at your college or university, if there is one, and to have that on your resume when you finally apply. For other jobs, like jobs in marketing or business, the best thing to do is to check the Association of American University Press's website to see what jobs are available. And there they'll be looking for experience, as of course all employers are. And if that experience is with publishing, that will be better. But it's not really necessary to have publishing experience to break into those fields.
I see. Okay. And just as a data point, how did you get your start?
I began as a reviews editor for a literary journal in an English department.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
Right, you're welcome. Thank you.
And to another caller here. This is if the caller would help us by turning their radio down. Sounds like maybe we're getting a little feedback there. The caller is in Urbana, line two.
Oh. Hello?
Yes.
If a competent scholar submits a 300-page manuscript to you.
Can you, sir, can you please turn your radio down? We're getting some serious feedback there.
Maybe I'll just turn it off.
Okay, well, that'd be good, yes.
Okay, I hope that's better.
That's good. That's great. Thanks. Go ahead.
Good. If a competent scholar submits a 300-page, say, manuscript to you in the humanities, and you accept it, is he required to make some sort of contribution, maybe a couple of $1,000 or something, toward the publication, for his question? And second, if it sells well, is there a chance that he eventually would receive some royalties?
The answers in order are, normally, no, we do not require a subsidy, but we would be glad to have it. We only require subsidies when some special requirement for the book is unusual, such as the need for color plates or an accompanying compact disc, that sort of thing, or there is exceedingly hard work. The manuscript is more than 300 pages, or it requires a lot of setting in Hebrew and Greek, that sort of thing. So, no, normally we do not require a subsidy. Remind me of your second question.
The other question was, essentially, if the book does well, can will an author actually expect to get something? So
yes.
It's something in the way of money.
Yes, but scholars should not normally anticipate that that will be very enriching, that for a typical scholarly book that will sell, say, 800 to 1,000 copies, the royalties will amount to a few thousand dollars.
Yeah, that's something that maybe would surprise people, given the fact that some high-profile writers who are selling bestsellers, we see stories about how much money those books make, very large advances, which is the amount of – essentially some publishers are saying, we will write you a check even before the book is printed in order to get you to let us publish this book and hopefully make a lot of money. You know, big advances, sometimes big sales for a very small number of books. The fact of the matter is that most of the people who write books in the United States could not live off of the proceeds from their books. They have to have a day job. So I imagine probably that is the case for most of the authors that you publish.
Most of the authors we publish do have other jobs. Most of them are involved in academics one way or another.
I want to just Colin, did we get at your question there?
Yeah, thank you very much. And, of course, one must always remember that the fact that the book is published often results in a raise in salary from the university. So in that sense, indirectly, one benefits.
Right.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus 580 with Willis Regeer. He is the director of the University of Illinois Press. Has been since the fall of 1998, and also before that, he worked at the University of Nebraska Press and also at the Johns Hopkins University Press, where he was director. Twice, he has been elected to the board of directors of the Association of American University Presses, sort of the trade group for the university press. Also served as its president in 2000 and 2001. Questions welcome if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier about some remarkable books that either you could say this press has published or university presses have published. And I guess I'm back on this notion that I'm sure people in the university press world would say that there are certain books that if we did not publish them, they wouldn't be published, either because they're controversial by their subject matter or because the publisher would think, well, if we only sell a few hundred copies, it's just not worth doing it. Are there other particular notable books that would just come to your mind where you could say, here was a great book, an important book, and if some university press hadn't published this book would not exist?
I can think of several examples from our recent list. One was a biography of Zane Grey, one of the most popular authors the United States has ever had, but who has only had one previous biography, and it was not all that well-researched. We have an author named Thomas Pauley from the University of Delaware who worked long and hard, actually conducted interviews with Zane Grey's heirs, and had access to materials that no one had ever seen before, which he was able to use for his biography. Yet, when he started to approach publishers, he found that they were not all that interested in Zane Grey. They felt that his time had passed. Fortunately, our press is well aware of the history of American literature. We knew that people were still reading Zane Grey, and we knew that this biography needed to be done. Our faculty board agreed. Our referees agreed. We published the book, and it has been a great success.
Yeah. I'm sure that even the University of Illinois Press, you have to think about potential sales, so that maybe you might say, well, we'd be really happy to sell 500 copies of something, or we might just be falling on the floor if we could sell 1,000 copies of something. But if you looked at a book and thought, well, this is a worthy book, it's a good book, but maybe you'd think we'd be lucky to sell 100. There's got to be some sort of line where you say, even we cannot do this because we think the potential is just so small. It's such a small niche that we would have to say, no, even we cannot do that. Is there some sort of break point? How do you make that decision?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are books that we consider marginal. And under current circumstances, those marginal books are books that we have to pass on. Mm-hmm. Not 100, but not far from 100 is the threshold. We are now publishing books with print runs as few as 300. Not many. We can't afford to do many like that. And the reason we are doing those few is from some prior commitment that we feel honor-bound to proceed with.
I think we have another caller here lined up on our toll-free line. Let's talk with him. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Hello. Can you explain what the minimum requirement is for a textbook to change from, say, a second edition to a third edition for college students? I'll hang up and appreciate an answer. Thank you.
The most important criteria would be how well the first edition or the second edition had sold. We publish a few textbooks and what we call secondary textbooks, that is, books that people will be using in graduate courses but will not be the kind of textbooks that most people associate with Algebra 1 or Introduction to Literature. We do have books that have gone into second and third editions, even fourth editions, and the major criterion for that is the field has to have, in some respect, substantially changed. Because one of our major areas is American history, and history goes on all the time, books like our history of baseball or American religions have fields which do change all the time and do need updating.
What's your biggest seller? Are there a couple of titles that right off the top of your head you could say, yes, these are by far things that we've sold the most of?
These will surprise you. One of our best books is called Thunder Below, which is the history of a nuclear submarine written by the admiral who commanded it. One of the bestsellers of all time for the press was Their Eyes Were Watching God.
By Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah. And that's a sad story about what good a university press can do and how it's rewarded. The book had fallen into obscurity. It was out of print. It came to the attention of my predecessor, Dick Wentworth, who recognized its importance thanks to scholarly input, reprinted the book. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And the licensee decided, well, that's a pretty good book after all, and decided that when that license expired, that the publisher took it back, and it is now published by a different press.
Yeah. So somebody saw you were selling a lot of books, you were making money, and they said, hey, we want this back because of the potential for sales. Now suddenly we've realized that it's really good.
Well, it's sad to say, but this is, in fact, one of the functions of university presses, is this rediscovery of things that are still tremendously important but have for some reason been forgotten. And stories like that, I'm afraid, can be duplicated by any university press.
Yeah. Something that I'd like to have you talk about, we talked in the beginning about the fact that, you know, it's a tough time for everybody, but certainly it's a tough time for publishers. And for university presses, I expect that part of the problem would be that libraries are big customers for you and that we have libraries that are certainly facing financial pressures. We have public libraries that are, there's more and more pressure on them to have more and more, and not just books in the library. And then as far as universities are concerned, you know, there's also budget pressures on them. And particularly there, it seems that there's more and more pressure on university and big research libraries to have all of the ever-expanding scholarly journals and be able to have those. So I think probably in both cases, that puts pressure on the amount of money that any library can spend on books, on old-fashioned books that go and sit on the shelf. That's something that has affected university presses?
It certainly has. Not only the budget cuts preventing them from being able to buy books in the first place, but our friends at university libraries have been exceedingly good at developing their interlibrary loan skills so that they need fewer books in the first place.
So if Library X down the road has the book, we know we can get it if somebody wants it, so we don't also have to have a copy of that same book on our shelf.
Exactly. At a meeting of university presses some years ago, a librarian from Pennsylvania gave us the very grim statistic that for a philosophy book, the interlibrary loan system of the Pennsylvania university system needed only 7 books.
Wow. Only seven copies. Where I suppose there would have been a time when every library would have said, well, particularly if it's a significant book, I guess every library would have said, well, we have to have our own copy on the show.
Well, Pennsylvania is full of colleges and universities, so yes.
Yeah. Something that I know, having looked at the mission statement of the U of I Press, is that one of the things that it talks about is pursuing the most innovative technology to meet the needs of readers. And I'm sure that today what that means is, now that we're in the digital world, that really goes to digital distribution, the fact that people want to be able to access material online, maybe the fact that some books have gone to the point where if you want one, we'll make one for you, but we're not just going to make up a whole bunch in the hope that somebody's going to come along and buy them. How are new technologies affecting your press?
Fortunately, we have a really good IT staff, and we are constantly looking ahead to the day when what has happened already in scholarly journals may also happen in scholarly books, and that is a vast migration to digital-only publication. We've had a number of experiments in this field from which we've gotten mixed results. We do anticipate that migration will occur. We do not expect it to be complete. We expect the prestige of the book to continue, perhaps even be enhanced if it turns out that most scholarly work originates digitally. The one other aspect of electronic publishing that's very important to university presses is how it affects our mission. And our mission is to distribute knowledge. And we can do that much more effectively if we can put works up online, and we can make the access to it much better if we can put it online free. As a result, our IT department put the papers of Booker T. Washington, a 15-volume set that we published, up online free, and it became one of the most hit websites among university publishers, and we received a lot of gratitude for it. Mm-hmm. We're now having second thoughts under this time about whether we should be providing that free.
Yeah. Do you now offer books on demand? That is, the idea is that the book exists in electronic digital form, and if someone says, I would like to have a copy of this book, then you make one.
Yes, we do that.
How much of that do you do?
Again, there is a level of sales where it becomes too marginal to proceed. Mm-hmm. So we do have to send unhappy letters to authors after 10 or 15 years saying that their books are going out of print, and they are really going out of print. But if there is a long tail for that book, if the book can still sell somewhere between, say, 10 and 20 books a year, then we're happy to keep it in print by printing these very low numbers. We are not to the point where we can do print-on-demand for single titles, although we're keeping our eye on that.
Again, let me introduce our guest, and I have a caller we'll get right to. We're talking with Willis Regeer. He is the director of the University of Illinois Press, which now is 91, celebrated its 90th anniversary last year, and is one of the bigger university presses. As we said a little bit at the beginning of the program, there's a pretty big range between the biggest one, which is the Oxford University Press, with hundreds of millions of dollars in their budget every year, and publishes many, many titles. And I think you said between Oxford and Cambridge, what percentage of all the university press titles are they?
Just about half.
About half. So the two biggest ones are about half. And there are many others, and some of them may only publish a few titles a year. So the U of I Press, with about 150 something,
that's right,
something in that range, is actually one of the bigger presses. Questions are certainly welcome here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We will talk with someone here in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You brought up my topic about digital publications. A lot of the big commercial presses are doing projects that are both digital and hard copy, like the Oxford Dictionary of Biography. Are you anticipating producing any books in both formats simultaneously, a digital searchable version plus print version? And the second question is, you have a huge backlog of texts that could be digitized or turned into profit. How has Google Books compromised or affected your ability to get money out of your backlog in terms of digital publication?
The first question is about simultaneous print and digital publication. We have done that since about 2000, but we had backed off of that because we still need to analyze the results. We are anticipating that is something that will come in the very near future, and my marketing staff is researching that assiduously. Second question.
That was about your back catalog and, you know, the potential for, I think, maybe also making that available in digital form.
We have gone back and digitized a number of our major books. I mentioned the papers of Booker T. Washington. We're working with our library now to make the papers of John C. Fremont available electronically. We did a book in the 1930s by a great Illinois scholar named Baldwin on Shakespeare and his sources that we have made available freely online. And we are looking to other things that might be similarly suitable, but right now we are restricted because it's expensive to do and we have to watch every penny. Mm.
The caller sort of made reference to Google and this project that they've embarked on where the idea, I don't know how close you can come to the idea, but essentially their idea was to scan every book there was and have everything be available online in an electronic edition. And I think that goes to the question of publishers who have back catalogs, who still may have books and may, you know, have titles that are several years to many years old, and that every year maybe you'll sell a few. And maybe you'd feel good if you could sell 10 or 20 maybe of those every year. If somebody like Google comes along and has now this vast digital archive of this kind of material, then you're even on your older books, that's really going to cut into the fact that maybe every year you could sell a few.
I think this is something we'll probably be watching with great care for a decade or maybe two decades. That Jane Eyre, for instance, is available online from any number of sources, but copies of Jane Eyre still sell. The difference between our books on, say, Babylonian medicine and Jane Eyre are pretty significant. So we will have to see what happens to the sale of books electronically before we will sign on to Google Books. Certainly Google Books is a great asset for scholarship and for readers who might not have other access to the books that are available on Google Books. And one place that affects us is in reprinting of things that were in the public domain, that university presses could publish books that had gone out of print, were in the public domain, but for which still a market existed. That has shrunk considerably because people can now get that material online and prefer to do so.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Willis Regeer. He's a director of the University of Illinois Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, you know, I think about the fact that over the last, 15, 20 years, as I've talked with people who are writers and who work with books and who are in the bookselling and publishing business, we've talked a lot about the coming of the digital age and what that means for books and reading. And I'm sure that there was a time when the subject of the e-book came up and an awful lot of people said, and I guess I would say myself, I like reading and I like reading books printed on paper that I can hold, and I like the way it feels and I like the way it smells and I like flipping the pages. And the idea of reading a book, say, on my computer, that does not appeal to me. But certainly there are a lot of people now who have grown up with screens, and now we have at least two e-books, electronic readers, that seem to be doing, fairly well, given the fact that it's new. Amazon has one, the Kindle, and they won't say how many they've sold. Sony is selling one, and there they said, I think that so far they've sold in the hundreds of, I think 300,000 of these things, Sony of their readers have been sold. And now people with other kinds of platforms, they're actually talking about, would somebody read a book on their cell phone? Well, I can't quite imagine that, but, more and more people have portable screens. And you have the possibility, you could download a book and you could put it on there and you could read it if you wanted to. What do you think is the potential for this kind of thing?
Well, I'm not going to shock you. I have a very ordinary answer. I think there will be room for all. That a lot of things that are now published in print because there is no other way to do it are migrating very rapidly to online publication. But television didn't kill radio. I'm happy to see the proof of that. Mm. And I do not think that online publishing is going to be the end of print. We are still seeing a lot of books being printed because there's a market for it.
Yeah. Well, I think about obviously one of the advantages of online publishing is that it provides access to a wide range of material, scholarly and popular, that people might not otherwise be able to get at, or maybe people think that that's just the most convenient way to do it. If you're going to read a physics journal, well, maybe you'd be just fine reading it on your computer and you don't care to have a paper copy. But it seems like, part of the idea that the thing that the Kindle people and the Sony people are trying to get at is that mass market books, trade books, mysteries and romances and science fiction and, whatever, that now exist in paper form and that people buy in paper form, people might be interested in the idea that they could have a thing, they could download the book, and they could read it that way. And if you could make the device appealing enough, it may be significant numbers of people would say, yeah, that's okay. I'll read War and Peace on my Kindle. I'm not so sure about that. But, you wonder for popular readers of genre fiction and stuff like that, whether that's the idea of a portable electronic book, what sort of potential that has?
Well, as you know, there are lots of questions that are bound up in this. Mm-hmm. The delivery is one. The nature of the book and the nature of the reader is another. What concerns us most is return on investment, actually selling the electronic project. And once a book becomes digitized, it becomes prone to piracy. And that we have seen is a severe problem already in the recording industry. Mm-hmm. And signs are that it's going to become larger and larger problem in traditional publishing. Mm-hmm. As long as people are willing to purchase digital books in a fair and reasonable way, then I think most publishers will find the transition not that hard and even advantageous, because you run fewer risks of overprinting. Yeah. You are serving a demand that exists and no more than that.
I guess I find myself thinking about the criticism that some people made of the music business, saying that they really missed the boat on the coming of the digital age, and that as a result now Apple is the country's biggest music retailer because they figured out a way to do it and get people to pay money
right
for the music. So it seems like they're sort of a parallel issue as far as publishing is concerned, that if publishers don't figure out the way to ride this wave, they're going to get pulled under in the same way that the big music companies did.
Maybe. I have very smart friends who have depressed me by telling me how much they like their Kindles. But when I ask them what they're reading, they're not reading things that are necessarily the kinds of books that we would publish, or reading them in the way that other people will read the books that we publish. This goes to the technological factor. I have yet resisted getting a reader because it doesn't have the features that I would want. But it's very easy for me to specify those features, and when that reader exists, I will probably plunge and start doing that.
Yeah. We have a couple callers here left and about 5 minutes left, so let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Not speaking about the university press, but about this electronic book idea for and whom it might benefit. I was looking into one for my mother, who's 88, likes to read, but her eyes get tired and she prefers large print books, and there's a limited amount of large print books available at a price that she can afford. And I don't know whether she could afford the Kindle but and buying the books that way, but it does offer the option of changing the size of the print for those who need that flexibility. And I also sent information about the Kindle to a friend who lives in Nepal, but husband has some U.S. income. And because it's hard for her to get books at all that she's interested in reading, or ones for her daughter. And I don't know whether she's going to follow up on that or not, but it occurred to me that it might reach, that sort of thing might reach people who have more difficulty getting things. I don't know if that's true for scholarly things and university press sorts of stuff or not. And the other thing that intrigued me about the Kindle is that if you travel a lot, it's a whole lot easier to carry your reading with you on that than it would be to carry a bunch of books. If you're going somewhere for a couple of weeks, maybe you don't have to carry anyone you like to read while you travel. It seems to me that would be another use for it. I have not bought one for myself or my mother. Haven't been quite persuaded, but I'm sort of keeping an eye on it. But those are the three things that I see as possible advantages. So I thought I would mention those.
Okay. Well, what do you think?
I think those are all good points. Amazon, in its annual report, said that they are having trouble keeping up with the demand. And according to their website, you have to get on a waiting list to get a Kindle, so it's obviously very popular. The Wall Street Journal reported that they had more than doubled what their expectations were for the sales of Kindle. Nevertheless, with all of the advantages of a Kindle, there are some things that that little device can't do that you can do with typical screen reading of other kinds of electronic projects. And I've become adapted to that, and I will want that in any kind of portable reader that I eventually buy. Kindle is expensive. It's over $350 right now, so the initial investment is high. But the caller is quite right that one of the advantages of the Kindle is that it does allow you to change the font so that if you want to see a bigger font to make it more legible, you can.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank the caller. I want to get one more caller here in the time that we have, someone on the campus. Line two. Hello.
Hello. I'm curious if the University Press does much publishing in regional interest titles, and I'll hang up and let you answer on air.
All right.
A great question. I hope you will check our website, the University of Illinois Press, and you will see that Illinois Studies is something that we take very, very seriously. One of our major books most recently is called Life on the Illinois River. We publish books on the history of Chicago. We have many forthcoming books I'd be happy to talk to David about in the forthcoming years. Yes, regional studies are very important to us.
And that's it. I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, that for all university presses, I'm sure that Nebraska, they're interested in Nebraska history, and Kansas, they're interested in Kansas history, and that That's University Press consider that to be part of their mission.
At least the state university presses.
Yeah, I mean, the state university presses. Well, we're coming down to the point here where we just about have to finish up. I guess one thing real quick that I was interested in, one of the things that I read, I was taking a look at the schedule for the last annual meeting of the AAUP, the Association of University Presses, and there was a panel on the challenges of environmentally responsible publishing. And I thought that was very interesting. It caught my eye right away. Apparently, publishing is not a very green business, is it? I mean, the physical business of producing books.
One of my favorite stories about University Press publishing is going, again, back to Oxford University Press. In the mid-19th century, there was a huge demand for Bibles that were being published by Oxford University Press because of orders for missionaries overseas. They published so many and used such acidic paper that they killed all the fish in the river.
So university presses are they making a particular effort to think green and to think about environmental impact of the business of the physical business of making books?
It is one of the things we think about. Yes.
Well, if people are interested, I'm sure you can find out more about the University of Illinois Press by going to their website and seeing some of the titles that they have. And also just want to mention again that the U of I Press, 91 years old this year, celebrating their 90th anniversary last year. Our guest is Willis Regeer, and he is director of the U of I Press, has been since November of 1998. Well, thank you very much for being
here. Thank you, David.
I appreciate it.